Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last week, another deadly school shooting. One dead, four wounded, this time in Cleveland. The shooter, just 14 years old. Kids see this on TV, in the headlines, on the internet, near or far. The specter of school violence is part of their lives. It is in their awareness and their imaginations and shapes the way they think about their schools, their peers, their safety, their vulnerability. Here's high schooler Tony Capone from Oakland, California, thinking about Cleveland and upping the death toll.
I like to think I do feel safe at school, but then again, you know, I'm pretty sure that the four people who got killed that day felt safe at school too before they got shot, so hey. The randomness is the worst part for me because that's somebody's life taken away for being at the wrong place at the wrong time, which is definitely unjust. And at the end of the day, their life is gone and, you know, there's pretty much nothing that you can do about that.
Their life is gone. It's a hard awareness for American teenagers and younger students to carry. We wanted to know how they're doing that, what they're thinking. Today we'll learn. This hour, On Point, American kids talk about American school shootings. We reached out to Youth Radio to help us. They sent out kids to interview kids. We'll hear their voices and more this hour, and you can join the conversation. What are your children saying about the Cleveland shooting, about the theme, the fear of shootings in American schools? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We will hear from kids around the country today, thanks to Youth Radio, and from adults who work with them. Let me introduce two of those right now. Joining us from New York, Drew Kahns, clinical social worker and safety coordinator at the Humanities Preparatory Academy, a 180-student progressive high school serving at-risk students. The school is 46% Hispanic, 37% Black, 10% White, 7%, well, everything else. This is his sixth year at the school and his 13th year working with New York City at-risk adolescents. Drew Kahns, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hello, Tom. Thank you for having me.
And with us from Santa Barbara, California, Jennifer Freed, co-founder of the Academy of Healing Arts, which runs teen after-school and in-school programs that help build self-esteem through dance and writing and leadership training. Her program helps youth across Santa Barbara, a city of 200,000 and home to many Hollywood stars, as well as families who live below the poverty line. She's a licensed therapist and has worked with teenagers for 30 years. Jennifer Freed, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom, for having me.
I want to get the sound of American students in our ears throughout this hour. We're going to hear the voices of teenagers. We want to thank Blunt Radio in Portland, Maine, Youth Spin in Austin, Texas, the Latin American Youth Center and Youth Radio in Oakland, California, Washington, D.C., and Atlanta, Georgia. Special thanks to Youth Radio, which trains young people to be radio journalists, and to Brett Myers for producing these people. Let's just hear a montage to begin with young Americans talking about, generally, even beyond the school, how their sense of safety in their lives is different from what their parents experienced as children.
My name is Melvin Berry, and I'm 14 years old, and I'm from Oakland. My parents, they used to be able to go outside, play hopscotch, middle of the street, do all that fun stuff.
But now my generation can't do that. My name's Elena Amos. I am 16 years old, and I live in Oakland. I can't be outside late at night anymore because it's shooting around my neighborhood and drugs. It's always somebody trying to mess with me or something.
My name is Oliver. I'm 17 years old and I live in Austin, Texas. In terms of the school violence, I think that is a brave new world of, you know, problems and things to consider. But on a whole, I mean, how can you compare the two? I mean, we have more, you know, technology to cure diseases that we couldn't cure, like, even 10, 20 years ago.
But when my mother was my age, she used to be outside all the time. And we just can't do everything our parents used to do.
Elena, Oliver, and Melvin, just for starters, interviews there produced by Youth Radio. Jennifer Freed and Drew Kahns, we're grateful to have you with us. This news came out of Cleveland last week, and of course, you know, it hit that sore spot that the country has had
ever since Columbine. It, well, that wasn't the first, but that was huge. And something like 37 or 40 or if depending how you count, many, many more than that incidents of school shooting and violence since then, which makes it a pretty steady drumbeat. And then that big arsenal we saw with the young man with the Cobra Brigade, was it, in Philadelphia, and all those guns spread on the tabletop. It got us thinking about how children process this because they are aware of it. Jennifer Freed, how much is this on American students' minds? Does it now occupy a part of their brain some of the time, all the time?
I think, Tom, that it's always within them. It's always something they're aware of in the background. I don't think it's on the forefront of their mind unless it's happened that day or it's happened in their school. But I think it's created an entire new atmosphere of fear that students feel toward one another, a fear of the stranger, a fear of the other. What used to be the strange, odd kid now may become the dangerous young person that could at one time hurt you or somebody you love.
Drew Kahns, what's your sense of how American students in elementary school, middle school, high school, how they carry this, in their minds, their hearts, their awareness of what's possible at school?
Well, I think, I think that, you know, I can really only speak for my experience here in New York City,
sure.
You know, over the past 10 plus years. And I think my experience is an interesting one because the story of violence and gun violence is an all too familiar experience in the lives of many of my students in terms of the environments that they live in the neighborhoods that they come from. But it's not an experience they have in our school. And so there's a real juxtaposition between the type of what Jennifer was referring to as this general distrust or guardedness around their peers, particularly around in neighborhoods outside of their own, and then the kind of comfort and ease with which I see the students traverse the hallways of my school.
Now, we should say your school is kind of a school within a school. It's sort of a safe haven within the quite large humanities, larger high school there. There were 2,000 students altogether, seven-story building in New York, and you've got a kind of enclave within that.
Right. It that's true to some degree. I mean, it began as a school within a school. It began as a program 13 years ago and then actually became its own school 10 years ago. And I had the privilege of working there as a teacher when I, you know, my first teaching gig the year before it became a school. So the last year was a program, and then I rejoined the school 6 years ago. So it really is its own, really its own entity. We occupy space in the building, but we don't share classrooms or teachers and you know, students are. We have a contiguous space on one of the floors. So you could call it an enclave. It's also just a shared space where it's a very different school experience. You know, a school of 180 students compared to an entire building with thousands of teenagers are two very different learning experiences.
Of course, students across the country sharing space with hundreds of others, thousands of others, and wondering what may be on their mind. Here's the voice of Anthony Fawcett. He is Berkeley, California. He'll introduce himself here and tell you what he's thinking.
My name is Anthony Fawcett. I'm 17 years old, and I live in Berkeley, California. I honestly think there's not something that could be done by the teachers. It's more something that has to change within the community and, like, the whole United States as a whole. Because, like, I know 10-year-olds with guns. I mean, I think that guns are way too easy to get a hold of. Like, kids just get guns, and it's become so bad that they get the guns from their parents because their parents are, like, 20-something.
I know 10-year-olds with guns. Jennifer Freed, we looked at the headlines just today and see incidents out of Washington State and out of Toledo and out of Massachusetts of, you know, in the young environment of guns and lists and the fear that comes with that. I mean, do students have it in mind these days that, well, somebody in my school today could have a gun?
Definitely. And I think what's worse for me watching this over 30 years is that young people today are growing up in a nation where it is propose that violence is an acceptable solution to conflict on the international level, on the national level, in the home life. And I think with the media and internet images of violence as entertainment, I think they're growing up in a culture where violence isn't abnormal. It's actually more ritualized as normal in their everyday life and what they're looking at and what they're hearing about.
Do you hear, if students talk about this, and I guess I wonder, do they talk about it with you? Do they talk about it with each other? And when they do they see it as something far away or a distant problem or something, whether or not it's hit them, could hit them, Jennifer?
Definitely. I mean, I've worked with thousands of youth over 30 years, and in my after-school program, which focuses on the development of character and emotional intelligence and conflict resolution, we're often talking about the uses of violence and the fear of violence, and youth are very open and vulnerable and concerned. And on the other hand, we hear from a lot of perpetrators. We hear from those young people that say, I want to kill everybody in my school. We hear from the young people who say, no one cares about me. Why should I care about them? I'm just going to beat them up. That's what we hear about.
Drew, what does it mean for young Americans to carry that kind of awareness, that kind of burden, that kind of anger?
Well, what I think it means, you know, the way that I can sort of answer that is to sort of highlight the experience of students in my school who don't carry that into the building. In other words, what I see is our students who are really able to be themselves, to actualize who they are, to be comfortable in their learning environment. I mean, one of the basic premises of the school when it was founded was that, you know, you can't have a safe, you can't have a learning environment if it's not safe.
Everybody believes that, but what a day in which that's a special school that has that as its hallmark. Drew Kahn's, Jennifer Fried, please stand by. We're talking about American children processing American school shootings. 800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about how American children are processing American school violence, American school shootings. They've become almost routine in the news headlines one way or another, and the kids know it. It's on their minds. It's a fact of their lives. You can join the conversation today. You see the headlines. So do they. Do you know what your kids are thinking about school violence, school shootings? Have your children asked you if they're safe at school? Have they asked you about school violence stories in the news? And can American children assume anymore that they'll be safe at school? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We've been joined from Santa Barbara, California, by Jennifer Reed, co-founder of the Academy of Healing Arts there. They run an after-school and in-school programs supporting kids there. And from New York by Drew Kahn's. He's a clinical social worker and safety coordinator at the Humanities Preparatory Academy in New York. One issue that's become large is the danger. We saw this in Philadelphia last week, of the kind of loner who, in our day and age, in our culture, turns to violence or the threat of violence or fantasies of violence in his or her isolation. Students are aware of that. They think about it. Here, three students reflect on why they think loners and outcasts are often involved in the shootings we read about.
Monsters don't create themselves. Society creates them. No one just wakes up one day, you know, perfectly fine. Like, I wouldn't just wake up right now and say, you know what, I'm going to go out and kill everyone I see.
If you haven't noticed, most of the people that are doing all these shootings, they're, like, mainly the folks that don't really talk to anybody and keep to themselves. All I really need to do is just talk to them like that. And, shoot, everybody needs a friend or something.
There are a lot of people that just get ignored hard, and that definitely does take its toll, especially, like, in high school shootings. Like,
school is a hard place for people who don't want to fit in with the stereotypical crowd. And at some schools, at most schools, I think it's sort of the jock and cheerleader crowd, but at some schools it could be kids who are at an arts magnet school and aren't doing very well in art. It could be anyone who doesn't fit into whatever cultural norm is going on there.
Yeah, I think Marilyn Manson himself, in fact, said after the Columbine shootings, when they were questioning him, they were like, so what would you have said to those kids? He said, I wouldn't have said anything to them. I would have listened to them.
That was 18-year-old Clive Baker from Silver Spring, Maryland, 14-year-old Zoe from Austin, Texas, 17-year-old Bronson Blair from Atlanta, Georgia. Interviews, stories there produced by Youth Radio for us, and we're very grateful for that. Jennifer Fried, what about the conversation that students have these days about the social structure? I mean, it's nothing new to have in-crowds, out-crowds, cliques, and kids on the margins. But now, at least in the headlines, that often gets associated with, you know, the trench coat, the gun, the danger. Is this something kids think about, talk about, a dynamic that they're working through in their minds these days?
Yes, and I want to first say that I think that we need an entire nation of schools like the one that Drew is teaching at and facilitating, because what I see is in most public schools and private schools, the focus is on academic performance and testing. There's usually very little done to help young people get to know one another, and it is the case that it's the young people who are most at risk are the ones that are socially rejected. It's not the ones that are necessarily doing poor academically, but it is that young person that comes to school that's internalizing their anger, and other people are ignoring them or rejecting them or teasing them or hassling them. They have somehow access to guns, which I think is just awful. But besides the weapon, the real weapon is that inside time bomb about to go off. And because teachers are so pressured and students are so pressured in most schools to focus on the blackboard and get their tests done and do their computer work, they're not looking across the aisle and saying, oh, over there, that guy or girl really needs help. And I think that's what we need to start focusing on, is the emotional climate of the classroom and the schools, not just the academic performance.
Students, parents, we want to hear from you about what's going through the minds of American youth as they read these headlines. Here's a bit, again, from Youth Radio on just this subject. 17-year-old David Bruenhe and 17-year-old Christina Lugo from Portland High School, Portland, Maine, talk about what they're thinking in school when they reach out to their marginalized peers.
I'm always nice to the kids who seem like they're a little off. Just in case, it's like insurance. I know that sounds really stupid, but
I think it's a good idea to be nice to everybody, especially the kids who seem like they could snap at any point, because you don't really know what's going on in their lives, and maybe they need somebody to be nice to them. Maybe they just need a little bit of love, you know.
Interviews for On Point from Youth Radio, Drew Kahn's. There it is. Do you feel students kind of sizing each other up in new ways these days against this news backdrop? Is there a new wariness, perhaps not in your blessed corner, but in your more general experience?
Well, I think that, you know, just returning also to one of the comments, and by the way, I think this program really mirrors the kind of what needs to be done, which is that you're listening to and incorporating the voices of so many different kinds of students, mm-hmm. and not just having the answers reside, you know, among the adults. I think that's one of the tragic mistakes that adults make, because we think that we have the answer. And the truth is that students are going to stop themselves and other students from being violent. But in that same vein, just returning to a comment earlier by Anthony Fawcett, I think his name was, where he talked about how teachers, he doesn't feel like teachers have the answer. He feels like it has to be a much broader issue. I think he speaks directly to the idea that this is a kind of much more pervasive, really epidemic than I think sometimes is played out in the media. When we have an incident, then, you know, people go into that particular school and they, you know, take apart, a shooter's kind of personal life, and which is not to say that it shouldn't be examined. Or that schools shouldn't be examined. But I think Anthony speaks to the idea that this, you know, and Jennifer touched upon it earlier, this is really something that is, you know, crosses, you know, the boundaries and barriers of you know, the school, and really gets into the lived, you know, the everyday lived experience of young people. And for some, in the realest way, you know. Mm-hmm. I think if you ask most New York City teens, you know, whether they know anyone who's been, you know, touched by gun violence, let alone themselves, you know, most of them, if not all of them, would say yes. So, you know, that there it is. You know, there it is. It's really an everyday reality.
Jennifer Fried, how do you read the way students discriminate between what's a reality in their school or a potential reality and what's news headline. I mean, the Cleveland shootings last week, I'm looking here at a news report from the Project for Excellence in Journalism, and they point out that the Cleveland shootings got as much attention in the headlines last year as the Nobel Prizes, almost as much as everything that went on in Iraq. We live in a media world. There's a lot going on. There's too much shooting going on, but everything that goes on wherever it is becomes part of all of our lives through that media world. Does that change the way students think about it? I mean, school gangs aren't new, schoolyard fights aren't new, but does the echo chamber of the media change it somehow?
Well, I think it's a desensitization process where there is so much in the news constantly that not only is it overwhelming all of us adults, it's overwhelming to the teen brain. And I think there is an entire nation of numb teenagers. What I find more than anything is that teens really don't have access to their feelings and don't have a lot of outlets to express themselves unless adults intervene and other teens intervene and help them do so. So I think that there's a reaction on a very global level of a certain type of emotional distance from it. Like, it's happening, but they're not exactly experiencing it in their body. It's just another news flash of something horrible going on in the schools, in the world, and they're taking it in just as they're digesting their food that morning. It's not that different.
Right, and we all do. I mean, in Cleveland, the details go out to everybody. You know, a gunshot to the torso, another to the elbow, another to the back, another to the chest. A student ends up in hospital because she was trampled by other students fleeing the gunman. Here, again from Youth Radio, is one girl's view of why she thinks schools may be failing young people.
My name is Zoe. I live in Georgetown, Texas, and I am 14 years old. I'm homeschooled, so yes, I feel very safe at school. But when I go to public schools, I will physically feel anxious. I think that people run school like a large army, and it's all about crowd control. When it is about learning, it's about pounding the same five things that are going to be asked on the test. It's not about what's interesting, and the kids aren't happy, and the teachers aren't happy. No one's really happy at schools, and I think that a lot of these shootings are due to the fact that school is an unhappy place, especially if you're not what our culture defines as normal.
Jennifer Fried, what about this happiness issue? It's very broad. I mean, Zoe is very well spoken there, but is there such a thing as a happiness factor in schools? Is it diminished because of the violence, or is it?
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more with all your youth speakers, actually. I think they say it more eloquently than anyone, but especially this last one woman is speaking for 90% of the young people that I talk to. School is not a happy place, and I think it should be. And what does it mean to be a happy place? I think Drew knows this because his school sounds like he's actually creating that environment. It's a place where people are inspired and motivated, not just disciplined. It's a place where people feel cared about, and their inner life, not only their exterior achievement, is valued. And I think we've become, you know, these classrooms, I go to them, there's 35 people in a public classroom with one teacher. And they come to school with incredible complex emotional lives. They have parents out of work in some cases, poor parents in other cases, parents in prison in other cases, divorced parents in other cases. You know, we live in a stressful time. All of us adults are living in it. What makes them any different? But what's different is they don't have the emotional tools to cope with that. And they're not learning that in school, and they need to be.
I want to bring another adult voice into this conversation, along with all the youth we're hearing from Parma, Ohio. Ronald Durkin joins us. He's director of safety and security in the Parma City School District. It borders Cleveland, which saw the school shooting last week. He's been with the district for a dozen years. They've got about 13,000 students, 22 schools. Mr. Durkin, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
So is safety a full-time job these days?
Absolutely, it's a full-time job. Every day, from time we get up to the time we go to bed, we're thinking about safety and the safety of our kids in the buildings, and how are we going to respond to it if something does happen.
Were your students rattled? Were you by those images last week from Cleveland of kids rushing through the halls, hiding under desks?
Well, it's the reality of what we live in now. I mean, when we see that in the news and in the paper, we react to it internally, and we get anxious about it, like the young lady was saying. But we know that we have a responsibility to keep these buildings safe. And the children in our buildings here, I didn't hear a lot about them commenting on it. I'm sure in some of the classrooms there were. I did get a lot of calls from parents who were very concerned and wanted to know about safety plans and how we're prepared in case of an emergency.
Do you think the kids weren't hearing it from them because they're more immune to this concern than we might think, or because they've become inured to it? It's common, or they're just busy with the next math quiz?
Well, I don't think they're immune to it. I think that they are aware of it, but I don't think that in their day-to-day life it affected them here, at least in our city schools.
Lucky for them. We're looking at school violence and how American youth are dealing with it. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's take a call from George in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, George. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a professor at a local university here, and last summer after the Virginia Tech shooting, I brought that subject up to my summer school course just to see what kind of response, if they want to talk about it. And what was surprising to me was in all their minds, in their worldview, this was an accepted risk you took going to school. And it was something that, well, that's part of school. That's part of what we do when we go to school. We're in society. And after just a few minutes of discussion, they didn't want to talk about it much. They want to just dismiss it and move on.
How do you interpret that, George?
I interpret it as accepting violence as level of violence in their life, because I can't imagine accepting that level of violence in my life, that it's something is norm. And it's worrisome. I mean, I had a classroom of about 18 students, and there were a mix from all over the country to come to this university in Nashville. And I teach biology. I'm not trained to do this, but we just had a discussion about it. And I think they accept violence it's more of a matter of fact and more than I can ever imagine. And that's what, to me, that's the worrisome trend. And I'm not sure what to do about it. I'm not trained to even, that's not my field, so I don't know what to do other than just keep discussing it when it comes up.
There's the voice of the biology teacher right out of the classroom. Jennifer, what do you say to George? He's trying to figure out how to interact with his students, but he sees them accepting this, accepting a level of risk that he says he can't imagine.
Well, I think the first thing that George should be commended for is he opened up the discussion. You don't have to be qualified to do that. The minute we start to become aware of something and have the ability to speak about it, we create the possibility of changing it. When it's denied or when it's put into disciplinary actions only instead of an invitation for contributions from the young people, then we silence the subject and put it underground, and then it becomes normal. In terms of George and what further he can do, all teachers, no matter what their subjects, can get trained in the subject of emotional intelligence, something coined by Daniel Goleman. A lot of teachers are getting trained in that. I just did a training yesterday for some high school teachers whose subject is English. But once you learn how to incorporate that in the classroom, you do become a more effective teacher. It's been proven the happier students are, the better they learn. The more connected students are to each other, the more able they are to concentrate. So I think we just have to shift our priorities and not accept this as a growing trend, not say, well, this is the way it is. The teens seem to get along and do okay until the next incident. Well, let's just wait and see, and let's just create more structures to got to detect guns and et cetera. Well, that's good. But we've got to cure the inside problem, the disease of despair that's rampant in the teens of this country.
It's not just mayhem and fear out there, though. Let's listen again to David Bruenhe in Portland, Maine, talking about why he thinks attending a diverse high school makes him less likely to attract ridicule for being different.
I feel perfectly safe in school. Portland High School sort of has this image of being like the dangerous ghetto school, and you walk in the doors and you're going to get jumped and stabbed and raped. But I think that there's such a wide variety of different people here from so many different backgrounds and walks of life that you can blend in pretty easily. Whereas in some other schools, like you don't blend in as well if you're different, because everyone's pretty much the same, so you get targeted for violence and hatred and stuff. But in Portland High School, there's just so many different types of people that people like me don't really stick out, even though I'm kind of odd.
David Ruinhey from Portland, Maine, describing his experience in school. Jennifer Freed in Santa Barbara, Ronald Durkin in Parma, Ohio, and Drew Kahn in New York. Please stand by. Listeners, we're talking about how American children are processing American school shootings with tape here from Youth Radio, helping us out so much today, and we're grateful for it. You can join the conversation, 800-423-8255. What are your kids telling you? 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about how American children are processing American school shootings. They've become to seem almost routine in the news headlines. The kids see that. The kids know that. It's on their minds. It's a fact of their lives. You can join the conversation. Can you imagine anything more distracting than the thought that just maybe someone in the school has a gun or might get one? Has your child talked about particular fears or particular peers that worry them at school? What do you tell your kids about how to put school violence in perspective? We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're lucky enough today to have from Youth Radio the voice of students from right across the country thinking about this themselves. Here are three students considering solutions to school shooting.
I mean, to be honest, having metal detectors like some schools would, I don't really think that would make a difference. I mean, yeah, it, you know, lessens the chance of someone bringing a weapon to school, but they could just, you know, throw it into the bush and wait till after school, then grab the gun again and just do all the shooting after school when everyone gets out.
They can have counseling for students.
Because if people felt like they could talk to people, then they wouldn't do some of the stuff that they do.
Teachers can also be trained in finding characteristics about depressed students so they can target the problem before it gets severe like that they want to kill somebody.
Even speaking for myself, if I had more people who I could talk to, like growing up, then I probably wouldn't have done so many rebellious things, but keeping it all in can make you explode. Maybe that was the situation that he was going through.
Also, other students can be nicer because there are some students that are just mean and for no reason.
That was 16-year-old Elena Amos, 17-year-old Tony Capone from Oakland, California, and 15-year-old Stacy Curry from Berkeley, California. Interviews brought to us by Youth Radio. Let's hear from our listeners. Ingrid joins us from Nashville, Tennessee. Ingrid, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I keep on hearing a lot of focus on the children who are depressed, who are different, who are socially rejected.
We heard it from the students right there.
Yes. And mm-hmm. The piece that isn't being focused on, which surprises me, is the bully that starts the conflict from the very beginning. We need, I believe, in schools, we need a lot more focus on dealing with the bullies. But the bullies are the socially accepted children, and they're the ones who are targeting these children, and I believe that is the beginning of the cycle of violence.
Ingrid, let us look at that. We did hear Elena Amos right there in Oakland talking about, you know, students need to be nicer because there are some who are just plain mean. Ronald Durkin, I wish you'd give us a sense of the kind of spectrum of safety precautions that you take in your schools, maybe starting right there from the in the school bullying front and then on to the boundaries of the school and beyond. Give us a sense of the what I understand is quite amazing panoply of measures you take.
Well, obviously, Tom, the bullying is an issue, and that woman's absolutely correct. In our school district, like in many other school districts, we do have bullying programs, anti-bullying programs, to help deal with those issues and to help kids to be able to come forward and talk about the fact that they're being picked on or they're isolated. Communication, I think I'm hearing from everyone, is the key to all of this, that the students have to be able to talk to a counselor, a teacher, you know, a significant adult in their life to be able to tell them what's going on. But we also have to give them avenues that if they do know that something's going on, how do they report that? How do they let somebody know without, you know, being looked down at by their peers or whatever? I think they have to get past this thing about telling on each other. But here in our district, we have a 24-hour school safety line that's anonymous where they can just leave a tip or say something what they don't think is safe in the school district, and we can address it immediately. It comes to me and my partner 24 hours a day.
All your schools are locked down. Everybody has to be buzzed in. Posters everywhere with that number. If there's any violent incident, as I understand it, You notify all students and parents within an hour. You are outside Cleveland, so I understand you've had some sort of copycat gang stuff going on, graffiti and colors. How do you deal with that?
You know, we have an absolute zero tolerance for the gang membership or any gang activity in our schools. I mean, they can't have graffiti on their books. They can't be wearing colors. Do some kids do that or try to do that? Yes, and we address it immediately when we see it. And we try to send a clear message that's not acceptable in our buildings. This year, our superintendent, Dr. Zadik, she is going to the point of where she wants kids not to have body piercings because she thinks it's distracting for the school. So we are hardening our buildings. You do have to get buzzed in to get into any of our buildings. Obviously, the state legislates that you have to have school safety plans. We practice lockdowns. We practice evacuations. We have a mass casualty drill coming up with the fire department, police department, surrounding communities, and the hospital. So in case there is a disaster, we can respond appropriately to it.
It's Ronald Durkin all over it there in Parma, Ohio. Let's go to Molly in Arlington, Massachusetts. Molly, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm the mother of two teenage boys, 14 and 17. And I have noticed that they are not fools. They are really smart, our teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
And they look around. We raised them saying, use your words. Use your words to solve it. Don't hit. But we really cannot blame the kids in this instance because they understand that in the wider culture, all of this use your words business is completely not followed, whether we're talking about solving international conflicts to what we're really teaching our kids. Why do the bullies think that intimidation and putting the other kids down is going to get them a lot further than cooperation and kindness? We believe in redemptive violence in this culture. We like to say that we're a religious culture. If you look at what we really teach and really believe, we are teaching that violence will set you free. And, you know, the fact that the guns are flooding our communities, if you look at the statistics of how many guns were in circulation 20 years ago, 40 years ago, what are we to understand about what our true beliefs are when we fill our homes and we fill our communities with weapons?
And you think our young people, our teenagers, are reading us more deeply than we might think, and that's what they're reading?
When we elevate, you know, people like to blame the media a lot. I don't blame the media. The media is mirroring what we value. When we elevate the Rambos and the and you know, just all of the solution of violence, that's mirrored in our films. It's seen in our foreign policy. My children are so distressed and disgusted with our leaders in this country. We are middle-class, normal American people. We're not radicals. They are absolutely disgusted and ashamed. And this is, you know, this is 14- and 17-year-olds who can say, why are we doing this?
The kids are watching. The kids are listening. Molly, you put a lot on the table. We'll look at it. Let me bring in another voice on a similar theme. Linda in Columbia, South Carolina. What can you add, Linda?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
You know, everyone's missing the point. This is not about the schools. This is similar to what your other caller said. This is about a generation that's being, there's always been bullies. There's always been kids that didn't belong. It's how they're reacting to it. And how they're reacting is with this unbelievable violence. And the reason is because we're raising a generation of young men on video games that are just consumed with violence and shootings and killings and movies. I've raised five children and still in the process. If I had one thing to do over, I would never have allowed my son to watch the violence that is on TV, showing torture. They're immune. They don't even understand. This is just like common practice to watch people being tortured. They don't understand somebody is actually being hurt.
Linda, let us look at that as well. Jennifer Freed, help us out here. Do you see, first to Molly's point, American school-age students picking up the idea of violence as a solution of redemptive violence? And then what about it? We've talked for years about it now, but is there a coming home to roost of all the violent images and games and you name it? Or are kids savvier than that somehow.
Definitely. I agree with everything Molly said and the previous speaker as well. What I see is, especially with the young men that don't have high social skills, they are locked in to those violent video games. They're obsessed and consumed by them. They become inured, as you said, to those images. They think of them as funny and entertaining. I work with those bullies that everyone's talking about. I meet those boys. They're often boys, sometimes girls. And every single one of those bullies that I've worked with over the years was at first a victim of bullying. They, as the young man said a while back on this show, monsters don't just come out of the blue. They're created by society. And every single one of the bullies that I've worked with started out being that young person who was persistently and consistently teased or harassed or beaten up by other people. So I think we have this multivalent task right now to not just address what images are being constantly bombarded into these teen psyches, but also knowing that bullying isn't acceptable. We all know that. But who created the bully? Who is that bully? We've got to get to know. We have to say the behavior is unacceptable. But when I've listened to these young men that have become bullies, every single time there's a story of horrific teasing and hazing that they went through before they made the transformation into being the one doing it, because they knew that's where the power is.
Drew Kuntz, for all that, it makes it look almost heroic but impressive the way students go to school every day, and most students, most of the time, most places, manage to keep themselves on a pretty even keel. What's your sense of how they do that, how they sort of partition their sense of what's going on in the world and keep that balance that most do to keep about their business, studying?
Because I think, and this is, you know, part of the joy for me of working with adolescents, because they really do teach me every day about resiliency. I think that, you know, teens, kids in general, but teenagers in particular, can be incredibly resilient, because I think, you know, I don't think that teenagers are passive in this process. I think that they're struggling actively with the world around them. And, you know, going back to, you know, the comment that I think David from Portland made when he, you know, ended up in a high school where that to him feels diverse and he felt like he could actually, you know, give voice to who he was, then the strength and the power of teens to kind of overcome the things we're talking about, because I hear a lot about kind of all these different factors that that contribute to, you know, to this kind of, you know, tacit acceptance of violence. But in my mind, when you offer teenagers a platform and you offer them relationship, very quickly they turn to not ignoring these things around them. Mm-hmm. Part of the reason they ignore them is because they don't have relationships that help them look at this. And so when you offer them that relationship, I mean, when I ask my students, and I think it's a direct, it's we're a small school in New York City, but I think it could be really generalized to teens all over the country. All of them said to me, you know, that violence like the kind in Cleveland couldn't happen at our school because they have relationships with adults. Every single one of them, that was their answer. And so, you know, that to me is very powerful. If you can walk into a school building where you have a relationship with an adult that's real, then everything can shift pretty dramatically. So I think that while a lot of, you know, the things that we're talking about are factors in the larger society, I do believe that schools are the answer. I really believe in the social institution of public schooling and believe that actually a lot of answers can and do reside there.
Let's listen once more to students around the country talking about whether or not they feel safe at school.
I feel safe at school just because I guess it still just hasn't hit close enough to home to me. I don't go to school like wondering what could happen. I just automatically feel that I'll be safe when I'm there.
I think a lot of it is about how you carry yourself. If you present yourself as a victim, you know, you're kind of asking for it. You just have to put your fight face on.
I generally feel a little bit uneasy because a lot of people are only there because they have to be there because they have nowhere better to go during the day and they really don't want to be there. So they just, you know, grow to be a little bit more hostile than they normally would be. And the only reason I feel safe at all is because I'm kind of big.
I feel pretty safe at school because then we have a lot of security guards and then I know my boundary of who to hang out, who not to hang out. So it's pretty common sense for me.
I'm constantly afraid in the locker room that the football players are going to beat me with towels like they usually do.
Seriously, I feel very safe at school. It's a really good place.
Oh, truthfully, I'm worried about basically SAT scores and college and scholarships. Other than that, I'm not really worried about walking down the street getting shot at.
There's the range, awareness, and resilience. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We heard there from Bronson Blair in Atlanta, Georgia, Christina Lugo in Portland, Maine, Craig Stewart, Austin, Texas, Carmen Wong, San Francisco, Clive Baker, Silver Spring, Maryland, David Bruenhe from Portland, Maine, and Amanda Newman from Atlanta, Georgia. Again, thanks for all that to Youth Radio. Chaim's calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Chaim, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. And thanks for this really rich discussion. The disappointing thing about it is that it only happens after there's another incident like this, and that our day-to-day way of talking about education, especially among our political leadership, is so comparatively shallow. All one hears about as the role of schools now is to prepare students to compete for the good jobs of the 20th century so that our country can be competitive in the international market. And the whole focus is on this pressure to perform academically.
So you want a moral education, an ethical education on top?
Yeah, and not only that, but that performance pressure is part of what creates the stress that explodes in these incidents, the stress on kids who aren't up to that performance and feel like they're an embarrassment to their school and they're not what it's all about.
If you're not going to clear the hurdle, maybe you're angry now.
And the kids who are driven to perform, to the point where that's all they have time for in their lives. They don't have time to cultivate human relationships with their fellow students or to cultivate their inner life.
Chaim, it's good insight, and it may be the last one we get today, but what an extraordinary conversation and offering of student voices we've been fortunate enough to have. I want to thank my guests in this hour, Ronald Durkin in Parma, Ohio, Director of Safety and Security in the Parma City School District. Mr. Durkin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom, for having me.
Drew Kantz at the Humanities Preparatory Academy in New York City. Drew Kantz, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Tom. It's a real pleasure.
And Jennifer Freed in Santa Barbara at the Academy of Healing Arts. Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom, and I want to mention I have created workbooks to use in the schools to address these issues, so you can check those out at www.indepthpress.com.
We've got it. Thank you. We want to thank the students who recorded the pieces for this show at Portland High School, Portland, Maine, Anna Flanagan and Libby Donovan. Wilson Public School in Washington, Olga Arias. At Grady High School in Atlanta, Georgia, Bronson Blair, Brianna Person, Emily Collins. At the Griffin School in Austin, Texas, Christopher Chaheen, Lena Lee, and Oliver Bradding, and Ankita Bradwajaj and Quincy Mosby in Oakland, California. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks to Youth Radio, this is On Point.